Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History. Hola, amigos. Hello, Tom. How are
Hello,
you?
Dominic. You've just had a haircut. You're looking very, very spruce and mean. Is this ready to... You're off to Disney World, aren't you?
I am.
In fact, by the time the people listen to this, you will be in Disney World.
Or in a COVID quarantine hotel.
Yes. So which would be worse, a quarantine COVID quarantine hotel or a six-hour queue to get in the queue?
I'll take the queue. Actually, do you know what, Tom? Some of our listeners have been in touch. So we have a Scotsman called Martin Ramsey, who's writing a book about the history of Glasgow Rangers Football Club, mm-hmm. and often sends me messages to do about our episodes. He has been in touch with all kinds of queue tips for me.
Oh, brilliant!
So the Rest is History Club. You know, it's a genuine community.
It really is, isn't it?
Well, isn't that nice?
Are we doing an episode on Disney? I can't remember.
We were thinking about it, weren't we? We made the promise that we would do it, and I actually think we should stick to it because I think it's a really interesting subject. And I don't want to preempt the episode, but there was we went to an opera about the life of Walt Disney,
really?
A Philip Glass opera. Yeah,
that's my impression of Philip Glass.
I mean, he's got one trick. Yeah,
he did one on Akhenaten too.
He did one on Akhenaten, exactly. Yes, which I've seen that one as well.
That's quite good. It's got a great song in it, which is unexpected in a Philip Glass opera.
But the framing device of it is a tour guide, isn't it? Taking people around.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Anyway, the Disney one was basically the same music. But it was about the life of Walt Disney. It was very good, I thought. I know a lot of people don't care for Philip Glass, but I do. Tom, we should crack on with the episode.
Yeah,
which
we should.
Okay. Discussion. So we have, you will be listening to this. Well, I mean, you'll have heard the Falklands episodes already, won't you? Because they were released in one go. So some people might describe this as gross self-indulgence to do four episodes on the Falklands. But,
well, it was, I think. But I think
was it? I think
But I think that gross self-indulgence can be of interest to people.
I think it. Well, we did.
It can afford innocent pleasure.
Yeah, French Revolution took what, 50 minutes?
Yeah. No, to be fair to us, about 55, I think.
The Falklands War took 4 hours. I don't know what that says about us. Nothing good. But
to be serious, on a serious note, I think what it suggests isn't just that we know more about the Falklands War than we do about the French Revolution, although listeners might come to that conclusion. But I think it also reflects the way in which this podcast is an organic thing. It's growing and evolving, and we're experimenting, and we're trying out new things.
Yeah.
And I think that that what this suggests is that perhaps the format is there for us to do kind of in-depth looks at certain episodes or events or whatever.
I agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more, Tom. I actually think I enjoy those more when we're telling the story. So when you did Sparta in two episodes, didn't you? Didn't you do Sparta
No, we did the Persian Wars in two episodes.
Persian Wars.
And we did Alexander the Great in two episodes. We did
Rubicon.
The Rubicon.
I really enjoy those because I like to get into the... I mean, people will know from my 3,000-page books that
You love a bit of detail, don't you?
I like a detailed narrative. I basically want to know what happened and when. In what order? And I don't like the sort of skating over because I always think that misses the complexity.
Yeah.
So actually, the French Revolution, it'd be brilliant to come back to that.
It would.
To do that in, you know, from the calling of the States General to the rise of Napoleon or something.
I mean, of course, the thing about the Falklands is that you have written about it.
So it was easy.
So in a way, you've got the notes there.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
I could just kind of read what you'd written and. Then I was up to speed. So with episodes that neither of us have written about, it will obviously require slightly greater investment of effort.
It would indeed. It would indeed.
But that's fine when I finish this book.
If you talk about your book again, Tom, the listeners will revolt.
I know. But
so not everybody liked the Falklands War as a subject because I think Judith also tweeted about this, unless there are two different Judiths who are not keen on the Falklands War. She was amazed we could produce four episodes on it. She remembered somebody telling her, a colleague in London who said when the war broke out that she knew for the first time how her father had felt at the outbreak of World War II, and Judith could only quell her laughter because she had to struggle to quell her laughter because she thought this was ridiculous. Judith says, coming from the Antipodes and being anti-war just seemed to her a continuation of the British tradition of travelling to the ends of the earth to impose their interests by force. I would totally disagree with Judith about this. I mean, you can listen to the Falklands War or not, but I don't think that's what it was because I don't think the British were traveling to the ends of the earth to impose their interests by force. I mean, the British didn't want to. They had no ambitions to fight a war in the Falkland Islands. And I think the argument that the British should just have, you know, when the Argentines invaded, the British should have sort of given up in some way, or just give, I mean, what that, irrespective of the ownership of the islands case, which is actually very murky, the problem is there are 2,000, I mean, I never quite understand the argument against the Falklands War, because I mean, what do you do with the people who live on those islands? I mean, of course, you could say, well, they're too small. But I mean, I've never heard people argue that self-determination has a sort of quota,
but
a quorum.
But, Judith's point, British tradition of traveling to the ends of the earth to impose their interests by force. Now, as we discussed, the Argentine press was very keen on portraying Mrs. Thatcher as a pirate.
Yeah, pirata.
So eye patch, cutlass, tricorn hat, all that kind of works. And that draws on a long Spanish tradition of portraying the English as pirates, going back to Drake.
It does, but I mean, the Spanish social workers.
No. But you did also discuss how the Falklands War drew on deep-seated memories in Britain of
Drake.
Yes, of our ruling Nelson. The waves and all that kind of stuff. And all that kind of stuff. So you could say that it is part of that continuum. I think that Judith's point is not.
Well, I suppose you could say that culturally. Yeah, you could say that. But I mean,
I accept it wasn't. It wasn't about sending gunboats in to impose our will or anything like that to kind of force countries to negotiate terrible trade treaties with us or things like that. But it was absolutely in that tradition, I think.
Well, I think it was the way it was portrayed in Britain. The weird thing is that actually the I suppose what I would say is the media and cultural portrayal of the war to ourselves in a way now has done the war a kind of injustice in a weird way. Does that make sense? Because
it does.
Of the sort of the gotcha, stick it up your hunter sort of style of public discourse. So that makes it easy for people to say, oh, it's just all jingoism and Nelson. Whereas in fact, you know, the people who were ordering, who were as it were, masterminding the war in Britain were, you would say, I think even some Argentines would say, were sort of, were ultimately more decent people than the people who were electrocuting poets and throwing people out of helicopters.
Yeah. Dominic,
many of whom ended up in jail in Argentina.
Dominic, don't you in any way think I'm against Nelson?
Yeah, well, that's what worried me, Tom. I thought that was very out of character.
I love Drake and Nelson.
Yeah.
But I can see why people from other countries might be less keen.
They should just wise up, shouldn't they?
Anyway, so
on that the will endear us to our overseas listeners.
Well, Dominic, on the theme of British bellicosity, comment from Matty 3.
Yes.
For me, the Falklands was the start of the trend for most modern British prime ministers having a war. Blair in Iraq, John Major pictured in the Gulf War, Brown wasn't in long enough to reenact the Battle of Stirling Bridge, or Culloden seems to have skipped Theresa May, and now Johnson quite overtly acknowledging that the war in Ukraine and our background support has diverted attention and saved his bacon over his many misdemeanors. So that's an interesting point, isn't it? That we hadn't really fought a war that attracted public attention since Suez, really.
Supposedly James Callaghan, very much a friend of this presenter, said many years later, I wish I'd had a war.
Well, he did, didn't he? I thought he served in the Second World War.
No, but he meant as Prime Minister.
As
Prime Minister. Major Gulf War, I mean, it's true Major went to visit the troops in the Gulf War, but I don't
think he looked ridiculous, didn't he?
He did look ridiculous.
He looked like Adrian Mole.
I don't know if people would ever say that
in his
Major.
army fatigues.
I'm sure I've mentioned this before in the bonus podcast, that I've met John Major and he's very tall and much more impressive in the flesh than on TV. Brown, but I mean, the two people who had wars, I suppose, are Blair and Cameron. So, and Cameron was a bit sort of doing a Blair, trying to be a bit of a kind of liberal interventionist, wasn't he? And Blair's wars were all about, so Sierra Leone, Kosovo and Iraq were all about liberal interventionism. That's quite different, I think, from Thatcher's war, isn't it? Because Blair never presented his
wars in a Nelsonian way. Ukraine isn't our war.
Yeah, I mean...
So, yet.
No, I mean, Boris Johnson in Ukraine, I mean, is he... I don't think he's doing that. Matty suggests that Boris Johnson is doing that to save his bacon and divert attention from his misdemeanors. I don't think that's true at all. I think that for the last 10, 8 to 10 years or so, Britain has been probably the strongest critic of, among Western European countries, of the Putin regime. And particularly after Salisbury, which I know is a subject close to your heart, Tom.
It is.
So I think actually what's happened is there's been a continuity in British foreign policy, which is very anti-Putin and has been for a while. And Boris Johnson obviously enjoys playing Churchill, as Mrs. Thatcher enjoyed playing Churchill in 1982. But I don't think that's purely sort of out of electoral self-interest.
No, what I think, though, is that prime ministers do quite enjoy interactions with the military.
Oh, yeah, they do.
There seems to be this point, they start off by trying to kind of cut them and get rid of them.
Yeah.
And then by the end, they're having top-level meetings in Cobra with generals.
Yeah, and I don't think that's peculiarly British, actually. So American presidents obviously love wearing those.
And the French, too. They're always sending armies off, aren't they?
Yeah. The Americans love wearing these special sort of wind cheaters that they get made, don't they? They're kind of military wind cheaters.
Yeah.
And the French, exactly. The French love sending kind of their paratroopers into kind of Africa.
Foreign Legion.
Yeah. Macron. I mean, Macron having that ridiculous photo shoot where he dressed as Zelensky in his paratrooper.
Yes, that was very funny. That was very funny.
I mean, that I don't think these are peculiarly British things. I think prime ministers or presidents often like it because they are maybe in a logjam at home. They're bogged down in the complexities of domestic policy, and they love a crusade, don't they? A moral crusade. I mean, slightly loaded term, a Tony Blair and crusades.
But, I do wonder about Boris, whether perhaps one of the reasons that he held on to power so tightly with Partygate and everything was because his intelligence briefings were saying it was coming. I wonder. Anyway.
Well, and this would give him an opportunity. He thought, if I can just hold on to February.
Yeah. I don't know. I just throw that out. Anyway, Gordon Smith. I think that Mrs. Thatcher has to have been driven primarily by the desire to overturn the occupation. If her main concern was UK political considerations, then military action in the Falklands would seem very risky. I mean, I think that's true.
Yeah, I don't think there's any. So it's such a common urban myth that Margaret Thatcher went to war because of domestic political considerations. I mean, some people might well say, oh, well, I'm biased, but certainly looking at the archives, I would say there's virtually no evidence. Well, there is, I'm going to say virtually no evidence. There is literally no evidence. You might well say, well, it wouldn't be on paper. But there's certainly none of her civil service people, none of the military people have ever said that the domestic...
It was too big a risk, wasn't it?
It was too big. I mean, the one thing she did was in her war cabinet, she shocked some people because she brought in the Tory party chairman, Cecil Parkinson, into the war cabinet with her. And, he advised on presentation and all that kind of thing. Some people said, oh, this is dreadful. She's just thinking about the domestic side of it. But actually, the story of 20th, 21st century wars, Vietnam is the obvious example, is that you have to think about presentation and you're mad if you don't. I think she was, her determination to, as she saw it, restore the freedom of the islanders, I think that was absolutely heartfelt. And I don't think there was anything cynical on that. I mean, of course, politicians are always opportunistic, but I don't think there was anything purely cynical in it at all.
Marcus Daly, he picks up on Jonathan Raban's coasting.
Did Which we call I foolishly, it I know I was a fool there. I called it sailing. I got it mixed up with Rod Stewart.
Or yachting. Yes. Yeah. Talks about it, having an excellent chapter on the Falklands, written from the perspective of a Guardian reading yachtsmen sailing around Britain at the time. In this miniature inverted cluster, the British had hit by chance on a perfect symbol of themselves. The Falklands held a mirror up to our own islands, and it reflected in brilliantly sharp focus all our injured belittlement, our sense of being beleaguered, neglected, and misunderstood.
Well, I mean, obviously you can tell that that is a sort of Guardian reader's view, because... I mean, a lot of people don't necessarily think that being the injured belittlement is the sort of default mode of the British. That's a little bit self-flagellating. However, it is a brilliant book, and he is so right about so many things, not least the way that people in the public mind, the Falkland Islanders did become this sort of, they were basically like Tolkien's hobbits. They were a sort of idealized version of the little people.
Their own happy life.
Harmless sheep farmers. Yeah. Well, yes. Which is true, but it obviously was massively romanticized and sort of sentimentalized and made them, you said, Tom, in the podcast about how the Argentines were the sort of perfect villains in the British imagination. The Falkland Islanders were the perfect martyrs.
Okay. Dave Waters agrees with you, Dominic. So you approve of that. I don't think everyone agreed with your thesis on Brexit.
No, some people. Mike Chapman, I can see his remark jumping out at me.
Yeah, okay. So Dave Waters agrees with Dominic on the Falklands echoing down the years to the current, including Brexit. I think the Brits, or maybe even more specifically the English, continue to be obsessed with our past. Second World War, First World War, even beating the French, which
you
was
never
more
hear
than
about
200
that
years
me.
Ago.
Never hear about that from
no.
me, Dave.
Are other nationalities quite so obsessed and find that obsession leaking into current affairs decisions in quite such a pervasive manner? Well, that's an interesting question.
Yes, I would say yes.
Do they? I don't. You think that in Europe, that tradition has been complicated by
So countries,
the Second World War.
So all those countries that were occupied in or lost the Second World War, obviously the Second World War has a completely different meaning for them. But other countries, are their politics informed by their history to the same extent, or versions of their history to the same extent as
didn't
that?
The French just buried a Napoleonic marshal, didn't they?
I didn't see that.
Yeah, I mean,
anyone who's spent any time in France, the idea that the French have, as it were, moved on from their history is just laughable. I mean, they have an incredibly profound sense of their own history and their own pride in it and all that sort of stuff. I mean, think about the celebrations of the Revolution in 1789 or the cult of Napoleon, still, you know, in some ways as strong as ever.
I mean, you could almost say the opposite, that maybe the British are of major European countries. Are exceptional in their, anxieties about history.
In our anxieties about history. So obviously the Germans have their own anxieties about history, but they're very different. But in our self-flagellation about our history.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I think there's something very... I mean, don't forget when the Black Lives Matter protests sort of swept over the world in the summer of 2020, and there was all the sort of statue demolishing. Macron... and other sort of French government ministers said...
And in Belgium too, right?
We're not having any of that Anglo-Saxon rubbish here. You know, we're proud of our statues and we'll keep them. And I thought that was really interesting that Macron, who's at whatever you think of him, has a very good sense of the sort of French middle ground, you know, the middle ground opinion, because that's how he's been able to win his elections. He was immediately like, oh, no, this is Anglo-Saxon self-flagellation. We don't do that. So, the weird thing is that the one thing that you hear so often from people in Britain is, oh, it's disgraceful that we're so proud of our history and that, X percent of people are still proud of our empire or whatever. This is an absolute abomination. But actually, I think the stats actually show that the British are much more conflicted about their history than most people. Anyway, I'm just ranting now.
Okay, well, as a counterpoint, Mike Chapman, your friend. Can I make a plea to stop the It's Like Brexit comparison?
The terrible thing is that he hadn't heard the final episode when he posted that. So then later on in the same chat, he said, oh my God, it gets worse.
I'm not sure how much value there is in saying it in many situations, but in terms of 1982, it's just wrong. To use another phrase from the time, the Falklands conflict was a short, sharp shock, over and done with in a matter of weeks, not a balls-aching year-on-year psychodrama. And somebody else I saw on the Discord, and I'm afraid I can't remember who it was, but it was a lovely comparison, said that if the Second World War were the two vaccinations, the Falklands was a booster.
That is a good, Well, that is a good parallel. It's not a good parallel, but it's a nice image. Mike Chapman, I disagree with you, Mike. Obviously, when you say it's like Brexit, I don't mean it's like it's exactly the same as Brexit. Nor do I mean the debate is exactly the same as Brexit. But I think there are threads. I mean, it's weird. When you view that book, Authors Take Sides on the Falklands, I bet you, I mean, I can't be bothered to do it, frankly, but I bet you among the writers who are still alive that the people who were deeply opposed to the sending of the task force would have been herbivorous kind of remainers. What Michael Frayn, the playwright, called the herbivores in the 1960s. And among the sort of the Kingsley Amis types who were all for the sending of the task force, I bet you there would be many more Brexiteers. I mean, it's obviously too simplistic to say one thing directly causes another, but there's definitely a thread between them, I would say. And that sort of flag-waving populism, I think, was very long-lasting.
I think that the balance among the intelligentsia, chattering classes, herbivores, whatever you want to call them, has swung much more towards scepticism, towards any hint of British patriotism, exceptionalism.
Since 82.
Nationalism. Yeah.
But I think it was quite pronounced even in 82.
I agree. But it was what, 70%, 30% then? I think
it was 80-20 in terms of the public.
No, but in terms of people in that book.
Oh, in that book. Yeah, maybe 70-30. Yeah.
I see. I think it would be much higher.
Do you think so?
There weren't many writers who were in favor of Brexit, for instance.
No, you're right. Yeah, well, this is a whole interesting subject in itself, and we have to be careful because I definitely don't want this to degenerate into a Daily Mail column. Not that, or indeed rise.
Or indeed a discussion of Brexit.
Or rise into a Daily Mail column, depending on your views of Daily Mail columns. But I think what's probably true is that the intellectual environment in Britain has become more politically monocultural. Maybe since, and you see that actually just in voting patterns. So if you ever look at how people voted, how academics voted in the 1970s, for example, it was much more evenly divided than it is now, where it's clearly not evenly divided at all. And I think you're probably right that if you did a survey of writers in 2022, you're right that they would be much more herbivorous. To give you an example, I was at a lit book festival a few years ago. Now, I voted. I'm going to tell the listeners how I voted. I voted Remain. And at this book festival, I was with a novelist, quite well-known female novelist, and the conversation turned to how would Brexit affect Britain's sort of the British culture and its export overseas in the decades to come. And I said something anodyne that, you know, I thought probably wouldn't affect it that much, blah, 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 blah. And she just gave this huge rant about racism and all this kind of thing. And I thought, God, how could you do that to the audience when you know that a good proportion of the audience are bound to have voted the other way? And I sort of thought then, well, it's probably because in the sort of literary world, it is such a bubble, a monocultural bubble, that actually it probably didn't occur to her that anybody who reads a book could have possibly had the alternative view. And I definitely think that has that sort of thing, which you can see elements of in the Falklands debate, this sort of how can anybody have taken the alternative view, is much stronger than it is now. However, I am conscious that I have now completely turned this into a tirade. Tom, do some talking.
Okay, pronounce Murray. Why is Margaret Thatcher always referred to as Mrs. Thatcher?
Oh, we discussed this on the Discord. It is because...
Did we do this last week? I can't remember.
No, on the Discord. I posted a reply to it. I mean, you did too. So that's a really interesting one. And it's because I think to call her Thatcher to me always just sounded incredibly loaded.
Well, it sounded like you were on The Young Ones. You were Rick on The Young Ones.
Thatcher. Thatcher. I think maybe you had to kind of, maybe that would fade. But certainly anyone in the 80s will know that a lot of people said Mrs. T or Maggie,
that's positive. So if you say Mrs. T or Maggie, you're supporting her. If you say Thatcher, you're against her.
Yeah.
So Mrs. Thatcher seems the kind of the neutral.
It does, exactly. That's why I did it. And actually, when I first did TV, BBC documentaries, the producer said to me, who was a former Labour activist, actually, he said to me, we should call her Mrs. Thatcher throughout. And actually, I do that generally because it completely changes the tone of the commentary. When you say Thatcher, even on television, it just sounds so loaded. And the counterpoint, I suppose, to that is not counterpoint. The modern day analogy is Boris Johnson.
Well, but there
you called him Boris earlier on, but some people get so cross if you call him Boris.
Yes, but equally, because everyone's called him Boris, therefore to call him Johnson is immediately making a statement about your attitude.
It absolutely is.
But equally, to call him Boris, of course, is not either neutral. So it's difficult. I think
there is no neutral. Because academic-y associates of ours who sort of start talking about Johnson, when I hear the first thing is that I don't actually know who they're talking about because I'm so used to hearing people call him Boris. But there's so much kind of venom in the word Johnson
it's
there was with Thatcher. It is difficult because I think you don't want to go sound like you're just a sort of Boris groupie. Anyway, we have completely spiraled off again.
Right. Well, listen. Let's leave the Falklands War because I feel it's just making you angry.
No, it's not. It's not. Let's go back to
Let's go back to what a very very exciting discovery.
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
This is we have fans in the fashion industry.
Well, we did our fashion podcast, didn't we, Tom? But what's very pleasing is we have fans among the top, some of the top models. Top models. So a model called Jasmine Horncastle. Jasmine, I'd love to think you're a member of the Rest is History Club. If you are, please announce yourself. So Jasmine Horncastle gave an interview to models.com and their new faces section. She just recently opened Gaultier Couture. I don't know what that means.
Jean-Paul Gaultier, I assume.
Yeah, but what does it mean that she opened it? Oh, she led the show. I don't know, whatever that means. And in the questionnaire, they said, you know, what's it like to have opened for Jean-Paul Gaultier and stuff? And then it said, what are you currently obsessed with? And do you know what she's obsessed with? History podcasts in general, she says. Well, I didn't know there were any other history podcasts. But my current favorite is The Rest is History on Spotify. And that she's trying to I'd like to think she's going to persuade other models.
That'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah. To be honest, when I think about our audience, they're the kind of people I imagine would be the our audience.
I think so.
Vickers.
Well, I mentioned in the episode that we did on lethal fashion.
Yeah.
I think that my daughter Eliza is very, very keen on all this kind of stuff.
She's an influencer, isn't she, Eliza?
She's a Vogue influencer, yeah. So she took us to see this designer whose designs were very kind of historical. They've definite kind of biblical theme, kind of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat look. There's a bit of a hint of the Tudor to some of them. So, and I think that designers are influenced by the history of fashion. So
yeah,
why not? Why
shouldn't models be influenced by the rest of its history?
But also, why shouldn't we be interested in fashion?
Oh, I see. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say that we're interested in models because that's the wrong... That's definitely not the wrong message.
No, we're interested in the clothes.
We're interested in humanity, Tom. That's what we're interested in.
We're interested in everything.
Now, look at this. Sam is absolutely incorrigible. I look at the top of the printout that he's done of the Discord chat and it says Mark Kirk Alves.
He is incorrigible, isn't he?
I mean, okay, Mary, I'm so sorry about this. So a Sunday thought exercise, knowing what you know of history and human nature, if you could choose any one, would you be rich, safe, or free, Tom?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, on that theme, actually, I'm just going to get it. The Rubicon.
Yeah.
My book on the fall of the Roman Republic.
What, you're just going to not answer the question but advertise your book?
I am. But I'm going to answer it by advertising the book. I have two quotes at the beginning of it, one from Caesar and one from Sallust. So just hold on a minute. Just hold on. Okay, so the quote from Caesar, human nature is universally imbued with a desire for liberty and a hatred for servitude. The quote from Sallust, only a few prefer liberty. The majority seek nothing more than fair masters.
Oh, so that's interesting.
So what do you think?
Well, I'd probably agree with, who said that? Was it Sallust who said the bottom one?
Sallust, yeah.
I'm kind of with Sallust in the sense that I would have put free as third. And I would have
What about your heart of oak?
It can be bought,
Tom. Woodworm.
So then rich or safe?
Safe.
Yes, I suppose safe I'd put number one.
I mean, it'd be no point in being rich if you can get mugged.
No.
I mean, that's the lesson of the reign of Ethelred the Unready.
Yeah. Yeah, or indeed, I don't want to offend Capel Loft, but that's the lesson of the 1630s. You know, if the king's going to tap you for some ship money.
Mm.
Or indeed, would you be rich in Pol Pot's Cambodia?
No.
I think no.
So basically not being killed.
Yeah,
safety is number one. It's the bottom line, isn't it?
And then you can work on wealth, and freedom is just a nice extra. I mean, that's a very authoritarian position, I know. But
freedom is an unusual value to emphasize.
Precisely. I think freedom is historically more unusual, isn't it? And what we would consider freedom anyway. We could degenerate into a sixth form debating society and say, what is freedom? Are we truly free now? All this kind of stuff. But I think safety is the one thing that human beings always crave above all. Safety for their families, for example.
But to prize liberty as a value, I think is historically quite exceptional.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I'm surprised you say that. So did people not... When the Romans prized liberty, for example, and they talked about liberty.
So the Romans are exceptional. The Greeks, okay. You know, some of the Greeks are exceptional.
Yeah.
But I don't think people in Egypt thought, oh, I want to be free. Because they didn't want to be slaves.
Yeah.
But the idea of being politically free just didn't come into it.
Yeah.
I mean.
Okay. So Mary said, no quibbling with the premise, no clevering your way out of a single clear answer. I think we've given very clear answers there. I think we agree.
Yes, I think we have. So safe, rich, free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Enyu Mantravardi, what are the most significant slaps in history? So this is off the back of Will Smith's slap. I know, I'm not familiar with slaps, Tom.
There's the slap that the priest of Marduk, of course, gave to the kings of Babylon every year on the feast day of Marduk. Yeah. Which was basically designed to remind him that Marduk was the true king of Babylon.
Okay.
And if the king bursts into tears, then that's a good sign.
Okay, that's kind of a bit weird.
Well, no, because the tears of the king,
yeah,
dropping onto the ground, it's like the rain watering the soil of Mesopotamia. So there's that. There is Santa Claus slapping Arius, supposedly, at the Council of Nicaea. So the Council of Nicaea, where they're deciding
I saw someone
the definition of the Trinity.
Someone had done a meme about that on Twitter, hadn't they?
Oh, really?
Yeah, they have.
Of Santa Claus.
Of somebody hitting Arius at the Council of Nicaea.
Yeah, so it's meant to be...
Arius is Chris Rock.
So it's meant to be St. Nicholas who becomes Santa Claus. But I think he didn't actually do it, because the earliest reference to this is... It's a kind of classic one.
I don't have a slap, I've got a headbutt.
Can I give you one last famous slap, which is it Boniface VIII?
What?
He was the Pope at the beginning of the 14th century. You remember Philip? He's having a massive bust up with Philip IV, the King of France.
I don't remember because I've never.
If you've read Distant Mirror, Barbara Tuchman's book on the 14th century,
I probably skipped the papal bits.
There's the exile in Avignon, where the papacy ends up going from Rome to Avignon in the 14th century. And it's precipitated by an attack on, I think, Boniface VIII by Philip's Italian supporters, who ambush the Pope in one of his palaces outside Rome and give him a slap. Mm. And he's so upset by this that he dies, I think, a week later out of indignation. And that is then what sets in train the... exiled in Avignon.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, that's good.
So there are three slaps.
I'm going to save my headbutt now for a future podcast.
No, Dominic, you can't. What's the headbutt?
Are you familiar with the work of a man called Eric Joyce? When I say work, he's an MP. He was the MP. He was a Labour MP for Falkirk.
Oh, yes. He's the one who precipitated Brexit.
Yeah, he changed history. Sorry, he Mike Chapman. History. Mike Chapman will be, there'll be steam coming out of his ears.
Yes, yes.
So he headbutted other MPs and a policeman or something in the House of Commons bar in, I think, 2013, 2012, whatever. He got drunk and he did all this. And basically, he had to step down as an MP. What then happened was that the Labour Party needed to choose a new candidate. But there was all kinds of scandal and shenanigans, because the Unite trade union was thought to have accused, anyway, of rigging the choice of a candidate. And as a reaction to this, Ed Miliband changed the rules of Labour, of all kinds of Labour Party things, including the leadership selection rules.
Yeah.
His change to the rules allowed people to pay £10, was it, Tom? And they could join the Labour Party and vote for Jeremy Corbyn, which they did. And obviously Jeremy Corbyn didn't campaign very enthusiastically for Remain in 2016 because his heart was in Leave, so people say. And it was very close to the referendum. So people say...
Yeah.
If Eric Joyce had not headbutted that person at the House of Commons bar, Britain would still be in the EU, and Mike Chapman would have been spared hours.
All this Falklands talk.
Hours of misery listening to me.
The headbutt that changed British history.
Yeah.
One last question, and again, I'm afraid on British theme, so apologies to non-British listeners, but this is to elucidate an important word in British English, and it's from Jeanette.
Oh, yeah.
To describe someone as wet, is a piece of British slang I've heard before, but I'm not 100% sure what it means. Please enlighten me. So this is specifically in the context of Mrs. Thatcher's cabinet in the 80s, yeah, where there were dries and wets.
Yeah, so it's a bit big enders and little enders, isn't it? So in that context, wets were... they were more moderate, I suppose, but they also, interestingly, the people who were more moderate, which were certainly often perceived to be more patrician, so they were sort of pinstriped, they were men of particular...
Noblesse oblige.
Yeah, they were kind of old Etonians, Oxbridge educated, they looked down, members of the right clubs, they were sort of sensible fellows.
They were like they were like the Earl of Grantham in Downton Abbey,
right?
Caring for the servants.
Is that Hugh Bonville?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're paternalistic. Yeah. And Mrs. Thatcher hated them. She came from a sort of lower down the social spectrum, and she thought they were too, you know, they would always appease, and they were all this, you know, they were too worldly, and there was no zeal in them, and no backbone, and they were spineless, and all this sort of stuff. And the name for them came to be the Wets. But of course, that the reason that kind of worked, it resonated, was because wet more broadly in British English means kind of weedy. I mean, do Americans call people weedy?
It's quite old-fashioned now, isn't it?
No, I don't think it is.
Isn't it?
Really? I mean, would you call someone wet? I would. I often do.
I thought it was kind of slightly old-fashioned slang.
It's very wet.
Dom, weedy, who's a young person, is saying it's London slang now too.
London slang. Mm. Sort of, but I wonder if it means... Yeah, to be wet is just to be sort of a bit limp and weedy and well-meaning and... Dom has written coward in the chat. I don't know if that's just abuse or whether that's I don't think he's talking about us. So it just means, yeah, exactly, cowardly. It sort of means, if anybody here, I mean, this is meaningless to 99% of our listeners, if anyone here read the Molesworth stories, there's a character in them called Fotherington Thomas who's always skipping around.
Yeah, so that's what I was thinking.
Singing, hello birds, hello sky, hello clouds.
Trees.
Yeah, and that's kind of wet, isn't it? Sort of weedy boys shivering on the sidelines.
So wets would be very keen on wearing masks.
Tom!
They'd probably vote Remain. I mean,
This is the sort of stuff I expect from myself, not from you. You're better than this.
But then the kind of the dries are, you know, hard-nosed, flinty.
Yeah. It's herbivores and carnivores.
Yes.
And Robert Toombs, the historian Robert Toombs, Cambridge historian, argues that that division is the single biggest kind of politico-cultural division in English history, doesn't he?
Whether you can dissent onto other countries.
That it's dissenters and Anglicans. I mean, it's the sort of Capel Loft thing, Whigs and Tories. It's well-meaning versus self-interested.
Are you saying, who are the Anglicans, self-interested or?
No, the Anglican, I mean, there's always this claim, isn't there? Yeah, they're self-interested. The Anglicans, I mean, this is bad news for some of our vicars. But I think in this, they're sort of...
I think that scrambles it. Because the dissenters are, they become the kind of the slightly, I don't think, so on the left, the wets are the centrists. I mean, wet is centrist.
I see, yes.
Wet
is
centrist. If you're on the kind of the hard left, the hard right, you're tough, you have firm views.
Yeah.
You know, if you're kind of hand-wringing and well on the one hand, on the other.
Change UK. Yes.
Centrist dads, says Dom.
Yeah.
Centrist dads are wet.
You're a centrist dad, aren't you, Tom?
Yes, I am. I'm not denying that I'm wet.
I'm a total centrist dad.
Yeah. So I know, but I'm, you know, that's, I would be a wet. There's no question about
centrist
it.
Centrist dads is basically our sister podcast, isn't it? The rest is politics. Aren't they both centrist dads?
Yeah, they are.
Dads,
yeah, they are. Yes, they are. Yeah, so if you want to know
in Alice Campbell's case, a centrist granddad.
Well, he's a kind of centrist Rottweiler, isn't he?
Yeah, I guess he is.
I mean, he's a bit... I think Rory's wet.
Yeah, Rory would be a wet if he was in the 1980s.
Despite the fact that he's unbelievably brave and has kind
but
of...
But that's the thing about...
...wrestled knives off Pashtun...
yeah.
gorillas. Exactly. And
but that's, you see, that's the thing about the Wets in the 1980s is that they were all like,
they were all on the MC.
Yeah, they'd all like, yeah, destroyed tanks and charged German gun emplacements. Yes. But now, weirdly,
but Mrs. Thatcher and, you know, Norman Tebbit, they'd never done any of that.
No, but the weird thing was that they'd done all that in the 40s, but then all these years later in the 1980s, they were sort of wringing their hands at the cabinet table and saying, "Well, Prime Minister, I don't know if that's a good idea," you know, that kind of thing. Well, she was. It's so that's the weird thing about it, that they had been so physically brave, and she would sort of say, "Cowards, the lot of them," you know, kind of.
Yes, anyway, to kill her.
Yeah,
to no, it's interesting. I think it's really interesting because it points out. It's one of those words where you, I think if you're raised in a particular culture, you know, there are certain words, if you're raised in a particular culture, you immediately know what they mean, but it's very difficult to explain because every explanation immediately is inadequate.
Well, that's it. Cause I would even the thing I posted on the Discord, reply to, who is it? To Jeanette from Who Dares Wins, which is a description of the political, of the political meaning of Wets. But then when I posted it, I looked and I said a Wet was somebody who had bottom. And I thought, well, that's very hard to explain to her. That just makes it more complicated.
Yeah. I think we should, at this point, draw a line under things.
Yeah.
Dominic, have a lovely time in Disney World.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be delightful, Tom. I'm really excited.
And we may be welcoming you back unless, obviously, I find someone better.
Yes, I've heard rumours about auditioning people in bonus podcasts, which are very disturbing.
We'll see. We don't want people to feel shortchanged. So the fact that you have selfishly gone off and had a holiday,
well, it doesn't. You know, it doesn't. You could have a holiday too one day if you like.
One day, I dream of having a holiday.
Right. So we will see. Well, Tom will be seeing you and speaking to you soon, but of course the usual podcasts will keep flowing because we've done them in advance.
We have
got the occult, we've got Agatha Christie, we've got all kinds of delights. So we'll see you soon. Bye bye.
Well, you won't, but I will. Bye bye.